Due to a scheduling difficulty, as was just mentioned, there might be a few topics that Rav Bayer didn't necessarily get to that he normally does get to, and they might actually, since guys that want to start taking Bechinas already tomorrow, might actually be on the Bechina. So you might want to listen to online. They have recordings from every single year. Any year, Rabbi Bleich basically covers the same topic. So if you listen to the end, the last 45 minutes of last year, you should be able to pick up those topics. Some of them we might address, some of them we might not. But that's what I would do in order to make up for that information that Rabbi Bleich perhaps didn't get to. Rav Bleich, of course, is the father of this movement of that I have tried to perpetuate, of giving out kitzur svarim that might be helpful for your own library in terms of the future. So, even though he gives out a whole exhaustive list, really, the svarim that everybody really should have is a Nisuin Kelchasa, which is two volumes, it's fantastic and exhaustive. And of course, the Otzar Poskim is something which is always invaluable to have. The Madrich, which I understand they give out now at the end of Smicha, is also a valuable resource. And two other ones which I would highly recommend are the Ksuba Kehilchasa, which is readily available in Svarim stores, basically a Kitzur Sefer and the Halachas of Ksuba is helpful. And they're also the Kuntres Aris Leareha, which is by a relative of Rabbi Rapp, I think his wife's uncle, Rabbi Sendrovic, who really has a lot of towns in America where he has their names and how they're spelled, and he talks about all the rules, and he has footnotes and such. It's actually a very fantastic work. Rabbi Bleich begins his shiurim, which I always find entertaining. He always begins, "I don't know what I'm doing here," because if you know how to be Masada Kedushin, then you don't need me. If not, then you're not. You shouldn't be involved in these issues to begin with. That's really taking a stand on an important issue. What does the Gemara mean? Kol she'eni yodeh b'tivgim v'kidushin lo yehe lo esek imahim. So the Pisrei Tshuva explains, quotes from Meshuvas Yaakov, that actually means that you should have nothing to do. You should have nothing to do with Kiddushin at all. It's understood very literally. If you're not Yodeh B'Tivgigim V'Kiddushin, you should have anything to do with it at all. The Taz, though, explains that line in the Gemara means something else. It means you shouldn't issue an original Hora, an original Psak, to state what's explicit in the poskim, what every rabbi knows how to officiate at a wedding. You don't have to do anything fancy or original. That line in the Gemara doesn't apply to that. The Shvus Yaakov takes it more literally, which is the way Rabbi Bleich was assuming. The Marasha, actually, on the Gemara comments, that why does the Gemara have Gittin before Kiddushin? Well, you think a little bit optimistically. First you have to get married, then already, then you can discuss divorce, but it should be Kiddushin Begittin. So Marasha says, no, it has to do with a second marriage. You want to marry off a woman to a second marriage, a man to a second marriage, you better make sure they were divorced the first time. So then, that's Kol She'eni Yodeh B'Tivgim V'Kiddushin, you shouldn't be involved in second marriages. But first marriages, not necessarily so. Anyway, be that issue as it may, there are a few things that we should, even if we're not going to take the line 100% literally, we're not necessarily all bekim b'tivgim v'kiddushin, all might be called upon to be masada kiddushin, but there are certain things that we should, precautions that we should take. We're going to start out with filling out the ksuba, because in my opinion, that's the first thing that you should do before you ever show up at the wedding hall. The ksuba should be filled out. If you're at your 50th wedding and you want to now start being a little bit more cavalier, so you fill out the ksuba at the wedding. But if you fill out the ksuba at the wedding, the propensity or the likelihood that you'll make a mistake exponentially increases. So therefore, it's always a good idea to fill out the ksuba before the wedding. And even in that scenario, I would always bring 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever extra copies of the ksuba with you, just in case a mistake does, in fact, occur. So the first thing that I would do is look at the ksuba and fill out the ksuba. So the first thing on the ksuba that you have to fill out is the date of the ksuba. That's the first thing. So what day? First you have to figure out what day is the ksuba supposed, what's the date that we want to put on the ksuba? So the complicated situation, which Rabbi Bleich actually just indicated to me, he did not get to. So if you have a chance to fill in on the tape from perhaps a previous year, that might be a good idea, is the issue of what if the chuppah is one day and the suda will be, is what if the, you're filling out the ksuba, the chassan's tish, is let's say today and the chuppah will be tonight. So when you fill out the ksuba, when you sign the ksuba at the chassan's tish, that's on one date. And then the chuppah is not going to be until that night. So what date do you put on the ksuba? So the Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, Simen Mem Gimel, Siv Zayin and Siv Yud Beis, I think it's on the Chomer, says that a shtar me'uchar is kosher, but a shtar mukdam is possible. Why is a shtar mukdam possible? Because you're going to be torah from lekucho shelo kedin. You'll go back and collect from this guy, sold property to somebody, I'm going to collect a loan. This guy sold properties, I go and collect from those properties that he sold, but they might have sold really after the loan took place, but my shtar is dated earlier. So I actually go and collect from people I have no right to collect from. So a shtar mukdam is possible, but a shtar meucher is kosher. So therefore, Rav Moshe's opinion was that a date of the ksuba should always be later. Since we're not sure when to date the ksuba, you might as well date it later. So if a chuppah is at night and the chasen sish is during the day, you should date it the night of the chuppah. The minig ha'olam, though, I believe, is not like, I think Rabbi Bleich endorsed Rav Moshe's position, you should date it later. But many have the practice of dating the ksuba on the day of the chasen's tish. Because there's a problem with pushing the date later, and the problem is that now the way the chasen is mechayev himself in the obligations of the ksuba is by picking up a sudar. He picks up the pen or the yarmulke of the handkerchief of the mesader kiddushin. And in lieu of picking up the handkerchief for the kinyan, the sudar, he is obligating himself in the obligations of the ksuba. The problem is, if he's not obligating himself until that night, so there's a big time lag in between his kinyan and the actual hizchaivos, when the obligations actually kick in. So the problem is a problem of kolsa kinyano. If I give money to somebody and I say, I want the kinyan to take place after 30 days, so the Gemara says, if the money is still around at the end of 30 days, the kinyan can kick in at the end of 30 days. If the money is not around at the end of 30 days, the kinyan cannot kick in. Meaning, if I give you money to go buy me something, or I give you money now that I should take ownership of an item after 30 days. So if the money is no longer around, the kinyan can't take place, because when is the money supposed to kick in? After 30 days. So over here, when is the obligation actually kicking in? Is at night, but you're doing the ma'aseh kinyan during the day. So chalipin over here would always be a problem of kolsa kinyano. Yeah. You can get out of that problem of saying me'asha, but the whole point Rav Moshe wants to say is you don't want it to take place now. You want it to take place at night. So if you're going to take place now, then date the ksuba now. That's exactly the point. So the Sefer Ksuba Kehilchasa quotes from Shlomo Zalman that no, you should date the ksuba today. Why should you date the ksuba today? Because the husband is being mechayev himself in the obligations of the ksuba from right now. The date of the ksuba should fall when the obligations kick in, and the husband accepts upon himself to be mechayev himself in the obligations of the ksuba from the time of the chasen sish. The fact that the chuppah happens at night is irrelevant. It's not that the kinyan only takes place at night. The kinyan is taking place right now, but in which case you should date the ksuba right now. So that's what the Sefer Ksuba Kehilchasa quotes from Rav Shlomo Zalman, and many others follow that as well, that it should be dated right now. And the problem is, on the day of the Chasen Tish, the problem is one of Mechzi Kishikro, or Shikra Mamish. Rabbi Bleich mentioned the issue, I hope, of the Vav in Vikhanina. Can you fill out the whole Ksuba before the Ksuba is signed? Because if you put in Vikhanina, we were Makabo Kinyan from him. That's not true. They haven't been Makabo Kinyan yet. So we discussed the problem of Mechzi Kishikra. Is that a problem? Is it not a problem? We mentioned that most of the poskim assume that it's not a problem. We're only choshish for Mechzi Kishikra and the shtar Maisa Bezdin. If it's not a Maisa Bezdin, we're not choshish for the fact that the shtar looks like a lie. Why? Because the whole shtar looks like a lie. Also, the shtar says, Havilei Leinsu. He proposed to her that she is now his wife. That hasn't happened yet. Until the ksuba is signed, we don't assume that there's a sheker here because there's a ksuba that's walking around that says people are getting married. It's a standard form of a ksuba and it has lots of things that haven't taken place yet. So clearly we're not concerned with Mechzi Kishikra, and you should fill in the vav of the kanina before the chuppah. Before you sign the ksuba, I'm sorry. Because then if you don't fill it in before and you sign it without filling it in, you might run into other problems. But that's if it's before it's signed. Once it's signed over here, though, we write in the ksuba, v'havilei le'intu kadas Moshe v'Yisrael, they got married, and then we sign it at the chasen's tish, and the husband's being mechayev himself now, but nobody got married yet. So Rav Shlomo Zalman claims, that's not Mechzi Shikra, that is Sheker Mamish, it's a lie. It says in the ksuba, v'havilei le'intu kadas Moshe v'Yisrael, and you're dating it today. Whoa, that's a lie. So in the Sefer Ksuba Kehilchasa, he patches up in the back that what it means, that really the shtar ksuba is not a shtar that's a historical document about when people got married. It's a shtar of obligations. And the husband is obligating himself from right now. The fact that they haven't not to get married until that night is really tangential to the main thrust of the ksuba. The main thrust of the ksuba is as a monetary document of obligation. So the fact that it says, v'havilei intu kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, is really irrelevant to this discussion. That's why many have the practice of dating it that day. I think in the Sefer Nefesh HaRav, Rav Shechter quotes that the Rav initially used to date it like Rav Moshe. He would push it off to the night, and then afterwards he switched to date it, the day of the Chasen Tish, whatever that. If the Chuppah is happening, if the Chasen Tish, I'm sorry, is Bein HaShmashas, then I think everyone would post-date it, because we're already not sure what date to put on the Chasen Tish. So once it's Bein HaShmashas, already put the next day, because many hold you should put the next day anyway. Or Moshe held you should put the next day anyway. So if it's Bein HaShmashas, always put the next day. But once you figure out what date to put on the Ksuba, so the first thing you have to write is what day of the week. So if you look in the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Gittin, Siman Kuf Chav Vav, he writes that the day of the week, the Shulchan Aruch writes that the day of the week is written the same way it appears in Tanakh. So it's Yom Be'echad B'Shabbos, Sheni B'Shabbos, Shlishi B'Shabbos, and they're all written as the way it appears in Tanakh, in Ma'aseh Bereishis. So all of them are Mole, the same way, I'm sorry, all of them are written Chaser. Sheni and Shishi are written Chaser. I think on the Madrich, which I assume you have a copy of. If not, I'll give you out. The Madrich has a handy-dandy little page over here. Where is it? Of the, I have a copy of it. Here it is. Of how you fill out the date. It's a nice, you can photocopy it. I usually bring, I think I have extra photocopies here. I do. So you can, he has how you're supposed to fill out, a nice little page, how you're supposed to reference, how you're supposed to fill out the date of the ksuba. The problem is they made a mistake on the first one. And it says, Be'echa b'shabbos, sheni b'shabbos, on b'shishi, it's written mole. In fact, in the Chumash, in Tanakh, it's written chaser. So sheni and shishi are supposed to be written chaser. Of course, if you wrote it with the yud, we know what you mean. But you're supposed to write it following the way it appears in Tanakh. And shlishi, revi and chamishi are written mole. The Ramah, and Sif Dalet, of course, makes this point that if you make a mistake in the data, we know what you mean. Everything is okay. That's based on the Gemara has a concept that Achrayus Tov Sofer. Achrayus means if I buy something from you, then if you had a previous loan, you had an outstanding loan when I bought this item from you, so it could be that if you don't make good on your loan, the item that I bought from you will be repossessed because you had no right to sell it to me. I'm a lokeach and I could be collected from. So generally speaking, if I'm smart and I know you have an outstanding loan, I'll put into the deed of sale that if I ever get this item gets repossessed, I expect you to repay me for the money that I gave you in lieu of this item. I mean, now you owe me. That's achrayus. So the Gemara says even we, it's a machlok to the Gemara, but we paskin that achrayus tov sofer. Even if you don't write it into the shtar, it's obvious. Nobody wants to buy something without the opportunity that even if it gets repossessed from me, that I'm not going to be able to collect the money back from you. That would just be a silly thing to do. Most people, when they buy an item, if it gets repossessed, in the event that it gets repossessed, they will want to be able to collect the money that they paid for that item in return. So the Gemara says, even if it's not written in the shtar, it's obvious. So the poskim assume that that's the same is true by anything that's obvious. Let's say you leave out chamesh salam. You write be'echa b'shabbos, be'echa b'chodesh nisan. Instead of writing chamesh salam, you know, shvamiyot shivim v'shtayim. So we all know that it's not a 5,000-year-old document. If it would be 5,000-year-old, it'd be somewhere in a museum somewhere. So obviously, it's not a 5,000-year-old document. So then we all know what you mean. If you wrote Chamesh Shalom Shvamios V'Shivim, maybe it's a 2-year-old document. So you don't know. So that wouldn't be Achrayos Tov Sofer. But anything that we can figure out without you writing it would be Achrayos Tov Sofer, and we would assume that that would be kosher. So after you write the day, even though, by the way, we can figure out what people mean, the custom is not to write Rosh Tevis, let's say. We're going to get to the day of the next. First, after you figure out what day of the week to write, you're supposed to write the day of the month. So the day of the month, we'll get to in 1 second. The day of the month is written the same way we would count Sfiras HaOmer. That's Bilashon Zachar, because Chodesh is Zachar. So this is also Zachar. So it's Yom Echad, Shnei Yomim, Shlosha Yomim, Arboa Yomim. And it follows the same rules as Sfiras HaOmer. It's Arba Ve'Esrim Yom. You always put the digits before the tens. The same Rebbe Haber, who was my predecessor, used to point out that if you have a Chumash, a Tanakh, and a Siddur, you can figure out how to fill out the Ksuba. Because the day of the week is based on Bereishis, and the day of the month is based on Sfiras HaOmer. Anyway, so that's the way you write it. Yom always goes first. Yom only goes first in two scenarios. Yom goes first. If I look at the chart, you can figure these things out. But Yom goes first by Yom Echad, otherwise it's Shnei Yomim, Shlosha Yomim. Or if it's Rosh Chodesh, 2 days Rosh Chodesh. If it's 1 day Rosh Chodesh, you go Tisha V'Esrim Yom, leads into Yom Echad of the next day. But if there's 2 days Rosh Chodesh, so you write Yom Shloshim L'Chodesh Ploni, Shehu Rosh Chodesh Ploni. You write it's the 30th day of this Chodesh, which is also Rosh Chodesh of the next Chodesh. So there Yom also comes first. Anyway, when you're writing the day of the month, though, you're not supposed to write Rosh Tevis. That's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. Even though we know what you mean, in the Shtar Tanoim, which a lot of times the lines are much smaller than a Ksuba. So there I've seen people write Rosh Tevis, because a lot of people are not so taken with the urgent need of writing a Shtar Tanayim to begin with. But if, so in Shtar Tanayim you'll see it. But in Aksuba, the general practice is not to write the Rosh HaTevis. The minhag is to write it out entirely. And that's the way that you write it. The Chadashim are also, went over Rosh Chodesh. The Chadashim are all written Moe also. Over here on this chart it also has it. Nisan, Sivan, whatever. Iyar is a machlokes, how it's supposed to be written, with two yuds or with one yud. That's why it says in the Shulchan Aruch that the shaila about getting divorced or getting married during Iyar. I don't know, I understand the shaila. We all know what you mean. There's no chadash Iyar. So, I don't know. But that's a discussion in the Shulchan Aruch. Anyway, we write in Mole with two yuds. You follow what it says in the chart. Just a few things to also note. You never write Menachem Av. The name of the Chodesh is not Menachem Av. The name of the Chodesh is Av. Mar Cheshvan, though, of course, is not a prefix. Mar Cheshvan is the name of the month. So you write Mar Cheshvan. Just make sure that you recognize these things. These are all fair game for the Bechina. Also, it's Adar HaRishon and Adar HaSheni, not Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni. All of these things are the way, the convention of the way things are written. The years are written B'Loshon Nekeva, because Shana, of course, is Loshon Nekeva. So it's Chameshes Alafim Shvameos, whatever. You look at the rules over here. And then also in between each one of the descriptive terms of the years, you write a Vav in between. So it's Chameshes Alafim Shvameos, whatever. There's always a Vav in between all of them. You also write Lebrias Olam, to the creation of the world. I think in the Madrach they also left that out. In the Madrach's Ksuba, they left out the words Labriya Solom. So just be aware, if you're following the Madrach religiously, make sure that you add the words Labriya Solom. Then you write Laminyan Shanu Monin. Monin is written Chaser. It's not Laminyan Shanu Minyan. It's Laminyan Shanu Monin. But it's written Chaser. That's the convention. And it's also Laminyan Shanu Monin, and that's how we get to the date Khan in this place, because it used to be that people would count different minyanim. They would count the years. Wouldn't always be to the creation of the world. It would be to this many years since this king took over, this many years since that prince took over. So we write Labrias Olam. We're counting to the time that the world is created, and the way that they count in this place. That's why we write the name of the place too. The name of the place that you write is the place where the kinyan happened, not where the chuppah is going to happen. Because again, the shtar ksuba is really a shtar hischaivus of obligations. So you write the place where the kinyan is. Rabbi Bleich was a big proponent, as we discussed at length, of writing a descriptive term with regards to the place. That it should be an ear, or if it's not a city, it should be a masa. He discussed, what does masa mean? Masa presumably means a place. So if you're not sure if it's a city, then you should write Masa, and he discussed which comes first. You should always write the Masa before in Ksuba. He thought that the descriptive term should come before the name of the city. However, in the Sefer Nisuin Kilchasa, he does point out that not everybody was as felt as strongly about this issue. There in the Sefer Nisuin Kilchasa, he quotes the Chazan Ish used to write Zichron Meir Bnei Brak, without any descriptive term. And then there's something else that's interesting in terms of the Chazon Ish writing Zichron Meir Bnei Brak, is that Zichron Meir, to the best of my knowledge, is not a city. It's a neighborhood. So Bleich pointed out, we don't write the name of neighborhoods. We write the name, that's why you don't write Washington Heights. It's New York City or whatever, New York. So that's two interesting chidushim with regards to the Chazon Ish, but also in terms of they didn't write it, that he obviously didn't feel the need to write a descriptive term. Rabbi Bleich also was not in favor of writing the name of the state, because state lines changed. He was in favor of writing the name of the city only. So therefore, Rabbi Bleich was against writing Brooklyn, New York. First, because there's no descriptive term, and also because there is no such place as Brooklyn, New York. Brooklyn was also as a city, but it's not a city in a state, so he was more in favor of writing Be'ir Brooklyn or Musa Brooklyn with a descriptive term. And then he made the point, if you're going to write the state, so he thinks you have to write B'medinas, another descriptive term. Brooklyn, B'medinas, New York, and the state of New York. I think even Rabbi Bleich would agree that if you're being Masada Kedushin in Brooklyn, Pennsylvania, that you should probably write B'medinas, Pennsylvania, otherwise people will think it's Brooklyn, New York. I don't know. We didn't get a chance to address that. But when I have discussed this issue with other poskim in yeshiva, with Rabbi Willing and Rabbi Schechter, so both of them are of the opinion that you can write. Rabbi Schechter, I think sometimes, it depends when you ask him, but sometimes more in favor of writing the name of the state. I think if you needed to identify the city, like I was once Masada Kedushin, a small city in New Jersey. So he said, I never heard of that city. How can you not write for Medinas, New Jersey? Nobody's going to know where it is. or I think he may. I think he made this point. If you're being Masada Kedushin in Brooklyn, Pennsylvania, so clearly you have to write the name of the state. Otherwise, no one's going to know where it is. So where it's not clear, the other posts in the yeshiva, Rebbe Wilk and Rebbe Shechter, were more in favor of writing the name of the state. But otherwise, they didn't feel necessarily as strongly about it as Rabbi Black. Rabbi Black was against it. They're more a little bit more open to it. Also, since the Nisuin Kolchasa says not everybody writes descriptive terms, you will hear lots of people writing, even Rebbe Min Yeshiva, writing Masada Kedushin in Brooklyn, writing Brooklyn in New York. It's two different practices about it. When you're trying to figure out what the name of the city is, so the first rule is you follow the way it's Huchzak. So therefore, you should always ask the Rav who's in town, if the Rav in town, how you're supposed to write the name of the city. The problem I've encountered is you ask Ron Rav how you're supposed to write it, but that Rav has been there for 3 years. And you ask the more senior rabbi, he says, well, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a greener, he just came. We've been writing it like this the whole time. So if it's, they write get in there, so there's everybody knows how you write the name of the city. But if not, everybody takes their own liberties in terms of that. So if you encounter that kind of discrepancy, you're not sure how to write the name of the city, or it's not Huchzak, so then you have to resort to Rabbi Bleier's rules of transliteration based on how it's pronounced in that place. And the way it's pronounced in that place could differ. For example, I live in Passaic. So I believe the Passaic is Huchzak for Ksivas Gittin. So there's a way that it's Huchzak. Rabbi Sindrovic quotes this whole story. The way it's Huchzak for Ksivas Gittin is one way. But then Passaic also is a river, which passes through Newark and Patterson. And Newark and Patterson, believe it or not, used to be larger Jewish communities. So Newark and Patterson are also Huchzak L'Ksivas Gittin. But the way that they write, so they would write the Be'er Newark, or Newark Ear, the Yazva al-Nahar, which sits on Nahar Passaic. But the way they spelled Passaic in Newark, in terms of writing it on the Passaic River, and the way it's spelled in Patterson are two different spellings. And neither one is the same as the way that it's Huchzak to write if you're writing it in Passaic. So it must be that they were Huchzak at different periods of time, and different people pronounced things a different way. The Newark community might have been Huchzak in one time, the Patterson community a separate time, and the Passaic community perhaps at a later time. So it all goes based on the way it's pronounced at the time that it's Huchzak. Just to review some of the rules, Bekitzer, because everybody spent an extensive amount of time on this. So the Kamas, just in case you didn't catch one of the things, the Kamas is always an Aleph. A Segol is an Ayin, a Tziri and a Cherik, a Tziri and a Chirik are a Yud, and a Shuruk is a Vav. A Tziri is one Yud. An I sound, he thought, is two Yuds. Isaac is two Yuds. But a Tziri, Shena, should be one Yud. The Pasach and the Shva, I don't know if he made this point, get no Nikud. Really, a Pasach, an A sound shouldn't get any Nikud, like Kalman or Zalman. Don't really get anything. It's just Kuf, Lamin, Mem, Nun. But the other sounds all do get represented, the other vowels. Sometimes they will throw in an Aleph just to break things up, like Lakewood. When they were first, I think, Koveh the Shem in Lakewood, so it was a big machlokas how to spell Lakewood. But now I think it's Huchzak, Lamed, Yud, Kuf, Vav Vav, Lay, so Lay, there's a Tzere, should be Lamed Yud, Kuf, Vav Vav, which is the Vu sound like Vud, and they throw in an Aleph Vav Dalet. Why an Aleph Vav Dalet? It should be just three Vavs in a row, like Vud. So I think the reason is because they felt that just looks weird to have three Vavs in a row. So sometimes in order to break things up, they'll just throw in a random Aleph, or Charles, even though Kalman and Zalman don't have an Aleph. Rabbi Henkin writes that Charles should have an Aleph in the middle. Teshin Aleph Reish. People throw in gratuitous Alephs every now and again, but that's in order just to get everything straight. Also, because we don't want to have things in a row, even though Woodburn, I believe, it's just, you know, if you're interested in this whole mini, you know, field, Woodburn is three Vavs in a row. It's Woodburn. So I guess not everybody felt as strongly about the three Vavs in a row, but once in a while you'll find random Alephs thrown in order just to make a point. The Cholam sound gets...
I was just going to ask about Sephardim, because this follows the...
Ashkenazi, I can't speak... Yeah, I can't speak to the Sephardi transliteration. The Cholam gets usually an Aleph Vav sound, so like Rabbi Henkin writes, Rose should be Resh Aleph Vav Zion, or Boca Raton, which I guess Rabbi Brander was Koveya, I think. So that Boca Raton is spelled, I think they were Koveya, Bez Aleph Vav Kuf Aleph, Boca. Aleph Vav. But then you'll find other sounds like buffalo doesn't have an Aleph Vav. It's just Aleph. So you'll find, or Hoboken is just Hey, Vav, Beis, three variations of Chol. Either Vav, Aleph Vav, or just an Aleph. It doesn't really make such a... Depends on the way it's Nikva in that town. One last sound, which Rabbi Blech, I don't think, mentioned, is an air sound. Like Staten Island. So in some places you'll see that with an ayin, Staten Island is spelled with an ayin, but Atlanta is spelled with Alephs. I even think San Antonio and San Francisco don't have the same spelling. One is with an ayin, one is with an Aleph. So try and figure out how it's Nikva. If not, you'll ask around how it should be spelled. New York, the way it's written is Nun Vav Aleph Yud Aleph Resh Kuf. That's the Maskana. I don't know why everybody in the wedding invitations writes it the other way. Nun Yud Vav. Maybe everyone's copying from somebody else's mistaken wedding invitation. But the way New York is Nikva is being written is Nun Vav Aleph Yud Aleph Resh Kuf. And it should be written on the same line. This is very important. Blaich noted that when you have a name that is made up of two parts, Chaim Yaakov, Sarah Leah, that's one name. And therefore, since it's one name, he mentioned it with regards to naming having the kala having the same name as the mother-in-law, so they should all be written on the same lines. And so too, New York should be written on the same line in the ksuba. If it's a printed ksuba, you're not going to have the shaila. Nobody prints a ksuba with half a line written on one line, half the line on the other line. But if you write a ksuba on the computer, let's say, if you're using a fancier nusach, or you're writing it, you want to go on the cheap, so you're putting it on the computer, so then you have to be careful when you justify your lines that it doesn't come out, that the name gets split up. The name, so after you fill out the date and the place, so then you have to fill in the names of the chassan and the kala. So the Maharim Mintz points out that the name of the chassan and the kala appears six times in the ksuba. Only the first and the last time do you write the name of the father. If the rest of the time, it's just the name of the chassan and kala without the name of the father. The first time, the Maharim Mintz also points out that the first time you write the name of the chassan and the kala in the ksuba, it's bachar and... There's no other descriptive term. After the first time, it becomes chasandanan. And after the first time, she becomes maras. Now they're married. But we're telling the story. So they started out single. So they're not chasandanan. They're not maras. And then later on, they become married. The descriptive term with regards to the kala, in terms of her status, we'll get to this later. The besultada, or beultada, all of that comes at the first time that the kala's name is mentioned, not the rest of the time. So every single time that you mention the chassan kala's name, you have to write a kohen valevi. That's part of their name. If the father's name is mentioned, so you write it after the father's name. It's Chaim ben Yaakov HaKohen. If you're not writing the father's name, so it's just Chaim HaKohen. Chassan denan.
She's a
Kohen? Huh?
She's
a Kohen. No. If he's a Kohen, then you would write...
Father's name.
No. If it's just her name, then you don't write a Kohen. No, it's only him. Only a man. Rabbi Blaich discussed if there was a cradle name, I don't want to get involved in this, if there was a cradle name, a name that she was given at birth, so he was basically, the bottom line is Rabbi Blaich felt that a cradle name, if she's given a Jewish name when she's born, then that name sticks with her for the rest of his life, for the rest of her life, or his life. He wasn't impressed with those who say that it's a nishtakach shmo, that it could be forgotten about. That's the name you should always go with. But if they did not have a Jewish name at the name and time of their birth, you should not award them or do them the great service of giving them a Jewish name some point later. Just to put a Jewish name on the ksuba, he made the emphatic point that you can write Shem Laz on the ksuba, and there's nothing to be embarrassed about that. Then he also discussed, Rabbi Blaich discussed the name, the family name. Rabbi Blaich was not in favor of writing the family name. A, he felt it wasn't necessary, and B, in terms of he felt it was a high likelihood that you might make a mistake, in which case, in transliterating the family name, in which case he felt that the shilos were created regarding the ksuba. However, Rav Moshe and the Rav and Shechter Rav Willig were more in favor of writing the family name. Rabbi Willig told me that he will write it if there's no shaila. If he's not sure how to spell it, then he'll just leave it out. But if there's no shaila, then he would write it. Rav Shechter is also more of a fan of writing the family name. There is an important distinction, though, because of this distinction. Well, why aren't they concerned? Is Rabbi Blaich's concerned that you might make a mistake, in which case, if it's a Shinui Hashem, maybe the Ksuba is puzzled. So family names are sometimes much harder to write than first names. So I think what might go hand in hand with this machlokas is another machlokas with regards to transliteration, is that Rabbi Blaich also, if you notice, the premise of his entire discussion was that we have very hard and fast rules with regards to how things are supposed to be transliterated. However, in many discussions with Rav Schefter, he's explained to me that he feels that there is no hard and fast rules how things are supposed to be transliterated. It's just you can't get it wrong. Meaning, all of language, as long as we can figure out what you mean, so then it isn't necessarily wrong. It's just, as long as we can figure out what you mean, it's fine. So, for example, you just have to look no further than in the way Rav Schefter spells his name. He spells it Shin Chav Tes Resh. Where I think according to Rav Bleich, it should be Shin Ayin Chav Tes Ayin Resh. Which I believe is the way J.J. Schefter spells his name. So, Rav Schefter is arguing, well, we all know what the name is. So, even if, I don't know if he changed it from the way he used to be written, but I'm saying the fact that it's not written with any ayins is a reflection of his position. As long as we all know what you mean, it really shouldn't be as much of an issue. For example, Rav Bleich discussed at length the name Ilana. Does it appear in Tanakh? Does it not appear in Tanakh? In which case, it should be written with a hey, then it's a Hebrew word, or it should be written with an aleph, then it's a Yiddish word. Rav Schefter would argue it doesn't really make a difference as long as we all know what you mean, which we all do know what you mean. So then, we know it's the name Ilana, so then it wouldn't be as much of an issue as long as we know what you mean. Or in Eretz Yisrael, for example, they have the common custom of writing the V sound with a Vez. Like Rabbi Ezra Schwartz spells his name Shin Vez Reish Tzadi. So that's, I remember fourth year Rabbi Bleich gave him a hard time. But it should be, according to Rabbi Bleich's rule, it should be Shin Vav Vav Aleph Resh Tzadi. That's the way so many spell Schwartz. So that's also, Rav Schefter would argue, as long as we can tell what you mean, it shouldn't be as much of an issue. When you're filling out the ksuba, if you're ever asked to be an aide, by the way, so some Masadri Kedushin will write the name of the Mishpacha, some will not write the name of the Mishpacha. If you're called up to be an aide, you just follow whatever the form is. And the Masadri Kedushin wrote the name of the Mishpacha for the Chasen Kalos, so you should write your name of the Mishpacha, the aide. If he didn't write the name, you come with your shitas. I'm writing the Shem Mishpacha. If the Masadri Kedushin didn't write the Shem Mishpacha, when you're an aide, you don't write the Shem Mishpacha either. Not the Masadri Kedushin. The Masadri Kedushin did write the Shem Mishpacha, so then you should also write the Shem Mishpacha when you're an aide. One time I was Masada Kedushin and somebody wrote, Yaakov ben Moshe, last name. Right? Yaakov ben Moshe, Moskowitz. So I never saw such a thing. Even from a Rabbi Chanan Shefter, I always get the impression you're supposed to write with Mishpachas. So I asked around, they told me that's the way the Rav used to sign his name. It was Yosef ben Moshe Soloveitchik, without the Mishpachas. But to be honest with you, I never saw that. Until that time, I never saw it mentioned in the poskim. So if you're going to write the family name, I think the common practice is to write Limishpachas to the family name. What if you don't know the name of the father? So again, we discussed this somewhat at length, but the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchas Gittin, the Siman Kuf Chavav, says if you don't know the name of the father, so you just write the first name, Moshe. Or Yosef Chasan Deran. Even if we don't know his name, okay, too bad. So the Dagum Revav already in the side of Shulchan Aruch says, well, I might not be chosis with Shnei Yosef Ben Shimon. Nachos of Shnei Yosef ben Shimon. So that was Rabbi Bleich's argument. I don't have to write the last name. Rabbi Chosh of Shnei Yosef ben Shimon. And Rabbi Moshe's argument was, of course you have to write the family name. What do you mean? A whole big town? There's no two Yosef ben Shimon? Of course there's a Yosef ben Shimon. Fine. So therefore you should write the family name. But how could you not be Chosh, he says the Dagum Rav, for two Yosefs? Or two Shlomos? Of course there's two Shlomos in this town. So the Dagum Rav says you can't leave it like that. So the Dagum Rav claims you should write the mother's name. That's the way the Madrich Paskins also. If you don't know the father's name, you should write the mother's name, like we have in the Gemara, Rami Bar Rochel. That was his mother's name. Presumably, they didn't know the name of the father. The father was an Achri, whatever. The Ksuba Kehilchsa, though, quotes Yeshayim that you could write, Yaakov Ben Avi Imo Shimon, Ben the grandmother. Obviously, there was some opposition to writing the mother's name. I think it's not because of, it's Nia's reason in terms of writing the mother's name, it's because nobody knows you based on a mother's name. Whereas a grandfather's name, people might know you based on the grandfather's name. So I think that was their concern. Instead of writing the mother's name, you should write the name of the grandfather. Rav Moshe writes, if you don't know, if the name of the father is not known, but he was raised by somebody else. That first case is if we don't know the name of the father and he wasn't raised by another person. Or the father is a Nachri, in which case you're not going to write the Nachri's name. So then you have that Shiloh, the three opinions. What should he write? Just Moshe? Just the first name Ben the mother's name, or should be the Madrich Paskins, or perhaps the first name Ben the grandfather's name. But if he was raised by somebody else, who you can write his name, so then Rav Moshe wrote Meikra, then you could write the name of the adopted parent. So you could write, he quotes the example of Serach Bas Osher, that you could write, even though it wasn't a real father, that's what you could write. Rav Moshe writes he doesn't think you should do that l'chadchilos. Rav Moshe gives you two other options. Rav Leif also dealt with a length that you could write ben mi shenishtakach shmo v'nikra ben ploni. Ben mi, this person who we don't know his name, and he's called ben ploni, or ploni de miskri ploni ben ploni, or he's this guy who was called ploni ben ploni. Fine. If the that's if the guy is Jewish, though. If the guy is a ger, so then Rabbi Blach also made the emphatic point that you have to write Ben Avram Avinu. In fact, in the past, Rabbi Blach was asked, let's say the guy doesn't want him, lots of gerim don't want, especially if he was adopted as a young child and nobody knows he's a ger. So then Rabbi Blach, I think, made the point that you don't necessarily have to read Ben Avram Avinu at the Ksubah, at the Chuppah. He thought you have to write in the Ksubah Ben Avram Avinu, but he also thought that we should don't necessarily have to cater to sensitivities, which he thought were Keneged Adin. He thought it's a great zechus to be Ben Avram Avinu. However, in the Sefer, there's a newer Sefer in Hilchos Geir, so called Mishnas HaGer. So there he quotes, you can look it up, it's in the library. There he quotes two opinions with regards to a child who's adopted when he's very young, and he's known by the adopted father's name. So then perhaps you can write, he quotes some opinions, perhaps you can write Ben, the adopted father's name. You don't have to write Ben Avram Avinu. Particularly in Aksuba, which we're not as makbid about in the Get. The Get might have to be more makbid. But in Aksuba, that Sefer was particularly open to the idea of perhaps writing Ben, the adopted father. And then he makes the point that that this is, poskim are more machmer about this with regards to women than with regards to men. Because a man doesn't really make a difference whether he's a ger or not. You want to call him up to an aliyah, you call him up Ben, whatever he wants. So that's fine for sure. So in Aksuba too, what real difference does it make? By if she's a gioris, so we need to know that she's pasul kahuna. So then, the Sefer Mishnas HaGer claims we should be a little bit more makbid about it. But you could also just write Giyur Tadah. You could write Ben so and so Giyur Tadah. But I guess you're basically giving it away at that point anyway. But if it's a man and it's a ksuba, there's room. And he was adopted when he was very young, so he's known by this name. So then, there's room to be makel, not to write Ben Avram Avinu. We do write, as we just mentioned, the Shulchan Aruch and Simen Samach Vav, which is a lot of the halachas of how you fill out the ksuba, quotes from the Rambam that we do state the status of the woman in the ksuba, in order that we should know if she's pasul l'kahuna or not. So that's how the custom developed of writing besul tada, as opposed to a woman who is pasul l'kahuna. If a woman was nivela l'nachri, so we just learned Yevamos this year, this is the topic in Yevamos, that then she is then considered a halachic zona, and she's pasul l'kohen. So Rabbi Willig used to make the point that he still gives a practical shiur on Seder Kiddushin for the Penner, I assume. Still does that? They still have it? On Wednesdays or something? No?
Yeah.
Nobody knows. They do have it, right? So Rabbi Willig has pointed out in that shiur, which he gives on Seder Kiddushin, that his opinion is that any girl who was on a secular campus, secular college campus, while she was not religious, if a girl goes, who lives in Flatbush and goes to Brooklyn College, that's not included in this, but if a girl is not religious, and she was on a secular college campus, and then she becomes a balas tshuva, so his assumption was that zanus is so rampant on college campuses that we should automatically assume that she is a pasul kahuna. Rabbi Bleich was not as taken by that tzvar. He said, well, we have a cheskas psula, we should employ the cheskas psula until we know otherwise. But if you do know that the girl was nivela, and then there's a question, how far do you really have to investigate that? Is the Masada Kiddushin, do I have to find out? So Rabbi Willig's assumption was, don't find out, just assume like that. And Rabbi Black's assumption was, you could assume a cheskes psula, and it might not be on the Masada Kiddushin necessarily to find out. If you do know that she was nivela l'nachri, and she is pasul l'kahuna, or if she's, we'll get to the bu'u in a second, but if you know she was nivela l'nachri, and she's pasul l'kahuna, so you have to record it somehow on the ksuba. But Rabbi Willig also pointed out that he thought you could write two ksubas, you know, and have the Masada Kiddushin hold on to the real ksuba and sign that one perhaps in private somewhere with two edim, but the ksuba that's read at the read under the chuppah, perhaps even signed at the chassan's tish, could be a different ksuba. Doesn't necessarily have to be that ksuba. Rabbi Willig, I think, even suggests you could have two kosher ksubas, and the Masada Kiddushin will make sure to rip up the second one or whatever. But if you want a pasul the ksuba also, that's also acceptable. Rav Moshe, if she, let's say she's not pasul kahuna, but she's stama ba'ula, so ba'ula is only entitled to half, or less than half. She's entitled to meya zekukim kesef, whereas a basula is entitled to masayim zekukim kesef. So the basula is entitled to much more. So Moshe writes, therefore, if a girl is a ba'ula, she has to tell the chassan. It can't be that she keeps it to herself, because then she's really cheating him out of money. He should really doesn't owe her as much money. But if, let's say, she tells the chassan knows about it, and the chassan doesn't care. So Moshe writes, then you can write in the ksuba besul tada. He's obligating himself in money. She's not possible kahuna either way. She had relations with a Jewish man before they were married. But now, the husband knows about it, so he can be mechayev himself to pay, and he can write in the ksuba besul tada, because it doesn't make a difference to anybody else. Rabbi Bleich, I think, points out that you shouldn't do that if it's obvious. If she's pregnant, so then you make a mockery of the whole thing. You write besul tada as a joke. So even though halachically perhaps you can justify it, but the rabbanim should not be involved in such a look ridiculous. The Pesach Tshuva points out in Sifkan Hey of Simon Samuel Chavav that if it's Bu'ula's Atzmo, so then perhaps she's entitled to the Masayim Zekukim Kesef Tzar of Medina. Because she only had relations with him, al das the kiddushin, and then perhaps there for sure you don't have any shaila. But Moshe said, even if the husband knows about it and he accepts to write besulta, then obligate himself an extra money that you could write besulta at that point. Rabbi Willig did point out, though, that what's interesting is in his practical seat of kiddushin, she is that you really have a double standard. It's really not fair. Because the girl, if she had prior history, the husband has to know about it. If the husband had relations before the wedding, the wife doesn't necessarily need to know about it. It's a little bit not fair. So we're quoting the name of Zalman Nechemia, that he thought that the girl doesn't have to tell him that she's really a ba'ula. She could tell him she was nensa. She can't lie in terms of saying she's a basula if she's not. That's stealing. He's obligating himself for more money. But if she was nensa, he also only has to pay half. So she could get out of the embarrassment of telling him that she's a ba'ula by telling him that she's nensa. I think it just leads to Shalom Bias issues down the road. She's going to say she was Nansa and she wasn't Nansa. It's a whole Pandora's box. So I would live with that double standard rather than... I don't know. When you're filling out the names of the Chassin, Kala, the place, the date... So the Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Mem Hei Sif Yud, you're not supposed to have empty spaces on the shtar. So yeah, why? Because you could write inside of the empty space. Oh, and by the way, he owes $1 million. So the post can point out that it really shouldn't be by the... we're marked but not to have any empty spaces, even where it says Be'echad B'Shabbos. I think some post can point out that he's doing Kilchasa, that really doesn't make sense by Be'echad B'Shabbos. It makes sense in the main thrust of the shtar. When you get more into it, by the names of the Chasin and the Kala, perhaps by the name, by the place, by the date, is it really so critical? What the guy's going to write, we're not going to figure it out that it's a joke when he writes Be'echad, I owe you $1 million, B'Shabbos. So it's a little bit odd, but Lamaisa, we don't like to have any empty spaces on the shtar. So what you do is, if you have a big fancy ksuba, what you should do is make a line like a check, which we're choshish for the same thing. So you make a line like the check. That should also be okay. Because of that same concern, Rabbi Bleich was also very concerned with ksubas that come in funny shapes that are not a rectangle. He assumed that the standard shape of a ksuba is a rectangle. If it's not a rectangle, let's say this couple likes fishing, so they want a starfish as a shape for their ksuba. That's where they met, the fishing, and they got a starfish, so they have a starfish. So the problem is, you could write over there inside all the arms of the starfish, and he owes $1 million, and he's selling his house, and he's becoming an evidently. So because of all that, so Bleich felt you really have to have a square ksuba. He was not happy with any ksuba that's in any other shape. I think other poskim would be more open to standard shapes, like if it's an oval. But then Rabbi Bleich claimed an oval, you could really just write, I owe $1 million, I owe $1 million, till it comes a box. But then, if you have an oval, let's say, or maybe even a starfish with a border. Lots of this comes up, because lots of people get fancy calligraphy ksubas. It's very rarely a shape of a rectangle. It's always some fancier shape. So maybe if there's a border, like with flowers around it, that you can't add on, then perhaps there's more to discuss. So you do have, you're not supposed to have blank spaces, or as Rabbi pointed out, even blank spaces on the side. It should be a standard shape, or it shouldn't be blank spaces certainly in the text of the ksuba. And then Shaila, the Sefer Ksuba Kilchsa, points out, it's a machlok, it's a poskim, can you write the lines in later? Let's say the Eidim sign the shtar. So you're not supposed to add things after the Eidim sign the shtar. So you might not even be able to add these lines afterwards. So really you should write the lines in before the shtar is signed. because of this concern as well, you're not supposed to have blank spaces between the text of the Ksuba and where the Edom sign either. Gemara, as a rule, and the Edom Mishita Achrona. We don't learn out things from the last line of the Shtar. Why not? Because the last line of the Shtar was usually left blank, to leave one space between the text of the Shtar and where the Edom would sign. So that's why we don't learn things out from the last line of a Shtar, because you could write, I owe you $1 million, but we all know that that's a joke, because there was a blank space over there. So that's why we generally write Hakol Shara V'Kayim, because it's a wasted line anyway. Hakol Shara V'Kayim doesn't mean that much. But even after you, let's say the calligrapher left in a blank line after Hakol Shara V'Kayim, so the blank line, one blank line doesn't cause such a problem, because even if you write something there, we won't learn anything out from the one blank line. The problem is, sometimes people want things to look nice, so write a whole text of Iksuba, and then they'll put the Edom at the bottom, way down at the bottom. Nu'um blank. So that's a problem. And you can't just put lines over there on the bottom like you would with a check, because then the Shulchan Aruch says if you put a sign underneath lines, it looks like you're just signing that the lines were done properly. I'm aware of the lines, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're signing on the shtar. So therefore, the suggestion that I've heard of is if you encounter such a ksuba, first of all, you should ask how the ksuba is going to look before the wedding and make sure this doesn't happen. But if you want to risk it and get to the wedding and fill the ksuba at that point, and then you realize that there's all this blank space before the Eidim, what you should do is just ignore the instructions and think out of the box and just sign underneath the text. Not where it says, nu'um blank, ignore that. And you can write on top of it, write underneath the text, the signatures of the Eidim. Or if you sign on the bottom, you could probably fix it by just having other Edom. Have 4 or 5 Edom signed. And you want to fill in the blank lines too. That's also another suggestion. Before you sign the Edom sign on the Shtar, or this is the first thing. So all of this, I believe, in my opinion, is the Eitz HaTayva, is that you should fill out the Ksuba before you, not the Edom signing, but you should fill out the Ksuba before you ever get to the wedding, and you could address all these issues with the Yishuv Hadas. If you're trying to address these issues at a chassan's tish with people screaming at you and banging on a table and ginger ale flying all over the place, so then it's a much harder place to think. So the first thing, when you get to the wedding, I would recommend you do all that before. When you get to the wedding, the first thing that you'll have to do is be makabel kinyan for the seder, for the tanoim. So you makabel kinyan from the two fathers. If there's no father, you makabel kinyan from the mother, that they agree to go through with the wedding. If there's no mother or no father, so then you'd be mekabel kinyan from the chassan and kala themselves, which I thought parenthetically should raise an issue. Rabbi Bleich raised the issue, hakam nachoshish v'dam chimud, at the time of the shtar tanoim. So his main point was, because the chassan and kala have no idea what's going on. At least the kala has no idea what's going on. She's sitting there in her bedekin room, and the parents are making all these deals over here by the chassan's tish. So how could she have dam chimud if she doesn't know what's going on? But if you'd be mekabel kinyan from the kala, so then maybe you'd have a dam chimud. I never heard him address that issue, but it doesn't come up that often. Baruch Hashem, anyway. At the time of the ksuba, you makabel kinyan from the chassan. And the chassan picks up the pen or the yarmulke or whatever of the rabbi, and in lieu of that, he obligates himself in all of the obligations of the ksuba. That's what the lashon and the ksuba means. The kanina minei. We makabel kinyan from him. The Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, and Siman Samach Vav, Sif Yud Gimel, writes the Chachila, the Edom should not sign on the Ksuba unless they have read the Ksuba. They know what it says. So the Sefer Ksuba Kilchasa points out that if everybody knows what it says, the minig is not that. Some Edom you'll see, they know what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, they'll sit and they'll read the Ksuba. The Sefer Ksuba Kilchasa points out not everybody is as makbid about this, because we all know every Ksuba is the same. So you'll know what it says in the Ksuba, but there are some who will sit and read the Ksuba first. That's following what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. It also has to be that the Edom, when they sign, that they know that the Chassan knows what he's being obligating himself in. Meaning the Edom have to know that the Chassan knows what it says in the Ksuba. So if it's obvious the Chassan knows, he's a Ben Torah, he knows what it says in the Ksuba, he reads Hebrew and he understands Aramaic, so then, okay, so it's just assumed like that. Yeshiva guy's wedding, we assume, make these assumptions that the Edom know what it says in the Ksuba and the Chassan knows what it says in the Ksuba. But if the Edom don't necessarily know that the Chassan knows what it says in the Ksuba, then really the Masada Kiddushin should explain to the Chassan. Well, if the Edom don't know what they're signing on, sometimes people want to be Mechabit people to assign the Ksuba, they don't know what it says, so everybody needs to know that what the Ksuba says, and the Edom need to know that the Chassan knows what the Ksuba says. So if the Chassan doesn't know, the Masada Kiddushin should explain to the Chassan in front of the Edom, basically, that he's obligating himself to pay money. And he should tell him how much money the Ksuba is Berech, if the marriage were ever dissolved. after the Edom signed, so the Edom witnessed this, then the Edom signed the Ksuba. The Edom should finish their signature with the word Eid. It might even be Ma'akev B'di'evet. There's rules in Shulchan Aruch. When is the word Eid? Ma'akev, when is it not Ma'akev? It also says in the Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat, Simen Mem Tesiv Beis, that the Edom have to know who the Chassan and the Kala are. Let's say this guy says he's the Chassan. How do I know that that's him who says that he's the Chassan? I have to ask him for his driver's license or something. So that's the sugya in Maseches Yevamos and Daf Lamed Tes called Ishtemod Inhu. How do we know he says who he said he is who he says who he is? So we're Mekel, it says in Shulchan Aruch, we're Mekel that if you have one aid or even aidim sulim who tell you that this is the guy that he is who he says he is. If you know that's him, so you know that's him yourself. But otherwise, perhaps you might have to have an aid tell you that he is who he says he is. And I think by the definition that the Masada Kedushin is standing right there, and he brings over the aid and he says, here's the chas, and that's basically your aid. Your aid that the guy is who he says he is. So we don't have to be as concerned with this issue. Even though Kedushin, we'll get back to the Bedekin in a minute. So that's basically the Chosin's Tish. You got through your Makabo Kenyan, the Edom saw the Kenyan, then the Edom signed the Ksuba. Then you get to the Chuppah room. And there's three ways of being affecting a Kedushin. There's Shtar, Bia, and Kesef. The Ramah writes that we have the minig of being Makadesh Dafka with Kesef. And the Ramah adds on, we have the minig of being Makadesh Dafka with a Tabas. The Ber Hetev and Simon Chav Zayin, Sif Aleph, quotes from the Mordechai that what if you don't have a ring? So can you use money? So the Mordechai says he cannot use money. Why? Because Daita Tzurasa Vita Debatla. What makes money money? The fact that it has some sort of imprint on it. Yeah, but the imprint is Avidi Debatla. It'll get rubbed out. I guess our money doesn't get rubbed out. They take it out of circulation before that ever happens. But the money in theory could get rubbed out. So Daita Tzurasa Vita Debatla. So the Mordechai says he can't use coin. He can't use money. Over the Pischei Tshuva there in Simon Chav Zayin, quotes from the Avnei Mehilulim who disagrees. He says, what do you mean? The Gemara says he can be Makadesh with Kesef. So it's a good Kasha. Okay, died to Tzurasa Vidibala. Hey, she only has a mind because of the Tzura, and the Tzura might go away. So he says, okay, it's a good Kasha. But Lamai says, you can be Makadesh with, of course you can be Makadesh with Kesef. That's one of the three things that's mentioned by the Gemara. And the Aruch HaShulchan also says, of course you can be Makadesh with Kesef. So that's where Rabbi Blaich, I think, has pointed out, Shechta as well, that if you don't have a ring, the best next option is just to use money. Can you use paper money? So that's a Pischei Tshuva in Choshen Mishpat. What's the status of paper money? It comes up by Pidyon HaBen. It'll come up by this too. Is paper money money? Or is paper money perhaps like a shtar? And I think the Pischei Tshuva quotes from the Chasam Sofer that with regards to Ben Adam L'Chavero, paper money is money. So then perhaps you could even use paper money.
I understand. Even if I have like a silver coin, and let's say it is rubbed out, not such a shash on the coin, but let's say it is, it's still worth the value of the...
She has in mind to do something else.
She thinks it's pretty.
But if there's no printing on it, then she has in mind that it's worth the value of the coin in front of her.
Like no.
It's still...
Let's say I give her a ring with a stone, which we'll get to in a second. So she has in mind X dollars. Then it rubs out. Now it's no longer worth X dollars. So the fact that there's a pruta there is irrelevant. She sees this fancy coin. Oh, boy. And she has in mind for the coinage, not for the... Not for the value of the metal inside of it. Which nowadays might or might not be worth a pruta. There's no silver coins in circulation. So.
Right. Would this make a difference between...
I have a feeling that a dime is worth more than the metal in the dime. Otherwise people would be melting down dimes.
Right, but like once the U.S. got rid of gold and silver backed, Kesef, that's...
Paper money you're talking about.
No, but even
coinage. That's a very good point. That's the whole shaila with whether paper money is viewed as, at least the coinage has some value to it. Paper money literally has almost no value to it. That's the whole shaila with paper money, is that it has no inherent value. It's all representative value. So that's the shaila. Okay, good. But now most poskim assume that paper money is considered to be money. Or at least coinage, for sure, where at least it has some inherent value.
So long. Which is obvious to Ishala, like some good knife or some kitchen appliance which she knows what
a becher, also a becher. Give her a becher. Yeah. Of course you can use Ishala Kesef. Great. Yeah. But of course you can use Ishala Kesef. So if you don't have a ring, all of those things are better. We're going to discuss borrowing a ring and getting a ring from somebody else. All of those are not the ideal. The ideal is to use Kesef or a Shava Kesef. A ring, of course, has to be worth a shavu pruta. If it's worth more than a shavu pruta, that's fine. But Rabbi Bleichel, as we just mentioned the issue that's quoted here in the Shulchan Aruch, that if she might make a mistake in terms of how much it's worth, she might think it's worth a lot. It's not worth that much. Like it's an evan which has a tabas which has an evan in it. It's a ring that has a stone. She's going to think it's diamond, then it's cubic zirconium or whatever. She's going to think it's a fancy diamond, then it's a cloudy diamond. So because of that, she thinks she's only being mekadesh herself for X amount of dollars, and it's really worth less. So you're not supposed to be mekadesh with an evan with a tabas that has a stone in it. Rabbi Bleich was even machmir with regards to engravings. Shechner Rabbi Willig are not is impressed with the problem with the engravings, because no woman thinks when she sees a ring with a little swirl on it that this is some unique art piece. Everybody's aware that these things don't cost any money, but Rabbi Bleich was afraid that she might not know that. We all know that, but she might not necessarily know that. So, yeah.
Is it really an assumption that even a standard wedding ring, women know how much they cost? Like, I know that my wife was very surprised when I gave her the ballpark figure of how much the wedding ring cost.
No, but she knows the value. They don't care.
She doesn't know how much it costs.
Right.
It costs a lot more than it did.
But everyone knows the value of gold.
I don't know the value.
Not the dollar value, but you know the value of gold vis-a-vis, not necessarily know the dollar value, you know it vis-a-vis other commodities.
I didn't know that at all until I went to buy.
Okay. Then you're ignorant of it. everybody else knows.
How do you assume that the cows know these things?
It speaks to your hasmada, but everybody else who seems to know these things. The Rama writes that the standard ring is with gold. If it's a copper ring and she's going to think that it's gold, you have to tell her that it's copper and it's not gold. Or if it's silver, so then she might think that it's platinum. So you have to tell her, no, it's silver. White gold and platinum, I think, are the same price around. So you don't have to worry about that. But never heard a woman complaining that she got a platinum ring instead of a white gold ring. But if there's a difference in value, she should really be told. The standard is gold. If it's something that's not gold, she should be told about it. The Rama writes in Simulam et Alf Sif Beis that the Mesada Kiddushin is supposed to ask the Eidim underneath the chuppah if it's worth a Shava Pruta. Why do we do that? We do that so the Kala hears that it's worth a Shava Pruta, and then she has a mind to get married just with the Shava Pruta. Whatever it happens to be worth ultimately is really irrelevant to her. As long as it's worth a Shava Pruta, it should be all right. That's why the Rama says the minig is that the kala covers her face. It's one of the reasons why the kala wears a veil, is so that she's not looking at the ring. Whatever the ring is worth, she's fine with getting married with that ring. So the Pesachei Tshuva and Dalet quotes from some poskim that if that's the case, that she's not interested in whatever the ring is worth, so maybe let's revive the suggestion of getting married with a ring that has a stone. She doesn't care what it's worth. So he quotes him. Maybe yes, or Sheth was quoted in the name of Moshe Soloveitchik, that perhaps yes. Perhaps nowadays, if you're going to use a veil, and the woman is not looking at the ring to begin with, she has a mind to get married with a Shavu Pruta, perhaps you could do a ring with a stone nowadays, but that is not becoming the minig.
So if you arrive at a wedding and then another, and they give you a ring and you say it's got a stone on it?
I wouldn't use it.
You decide to say, do you have any money in your pocket?
This is something you should deal with before. Yeah, make sure that there is a kosher ring. But yeah, or I wouldn't use money. I would try and find the Shabbat Kesef or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Money also, though. We said money. Paper money is more of a shayla, so maybe coinage is better. But Aruch HaShulchan and Rabbi Bleich, Rabbi Willig, we're not in favor of ever using a ring that has a stone in it. Of course, the ring has to belong to the husband. That's quoted here in Shulchan Aruch Simon and Chavches. So he has to then have made a valid kinyan on the ring. So the Meluim discuss we pass in the Gemara. It's next year's topic that Dvar Torah Mos Konos. Money is Kona something, not Meshicha. But let's say a guy pays with a check. So a check is a shaila in the poskim. Most poskim consider a check to be not to be money. If a check would be money, then if I give you a check and the check bounces, you shouldn't be able to collect. I gave you the money already. So obviously we assume a check is not money. A check is some sort of star or something. So in which case, if you only paid with a check, then perhaps you're not kona the ring d'oraisa. So you'd have to, then you get involved in a shayla. There's a kinyan d'rabbanan work for an inyan, which is d'oraisa, maimon shloshtan shayla, anyway. So make sure the guy owns the ring. Basically, let him pay with a credit card. Most posim hold, it's also machlok sepasim. Some posim hold credit card is a kinyan. Rabbi Bleich holds it is. Others feel differently about credit card payments. So make sure he's paid the credit card bill before, or the check has been paid, or whatever, before it comes time to the wedding. If he doesn't have a ring, so the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Chav Ches Sif Yud Tes discusses the possibility of borrowing a ring, that does work. Why? Because he quotes from the Rosh that the borrowing over here is really like a matano manas lahaksa. The guy knows that I'm using it to be makadesh this woman, so he's giving it to me entirely. It's not a she'ela, it's a matana with the condition that I will return it. So matana manas lahaksir works for kedusha. Now the Shulchan Aruch points out there, simen chaf tes if aleph, I can't give it to the woman as a matana manas lahaksir. If I give it to her, saying here I am a kedusha with the bazu, as long as you give it back, no, that looks like chalipin. So that's no good. But if I own it as a matana manas lahaksir, I give it to her entirely, meaning everything that I own in the ring, I give to her, without mentioning the stipulation, so it doesn't look like chalipin, such a kiddushin would in fact be good. The Pesachei Tshuva quotes from a Mishnah Nes Yaakov that this gets involved in the whole Lamdash Shaila from Yisachas Kiddushin. What is the nature of a matana manas lahaksir? Is a matana manas lahaksir a full matana with a condition, with a stipulation attached, or it's not a full matana, it's really only an 80% matana? So if it's only an 80% matana, I can't be makadish with such a thing. So therefore, the Pesachei Tshuva quotes a Mishnah Nes Yaakov, really you shouldn't do this whole borrowing a matana manas lahaksir story. You should, if someone wants to give you a ring, then they have to give it to you in its entirety. Rabbi Black pointed out that he had this case with the heirloom ring or whatever, and he had to convince them in 10 different languages that they're actually giving the ring over to the chassan and it's his. He could decide not to marry, he could decide to marry her. All of these things are not really, if you want to do it, that's the way you would have to do it. The Beis Shmuel writes it over there in Simen Chav Ches, that therefore the Masada Kiddushin asked the chassan underneath the wedding in the presence of the Yedim, is this your ring? Just to make sure that, again, these two things, that it's worth a shevet proof, and that the ring belongs to him, so that the Edom should know that the ring belongs to him. If parents are giving the ring to the chassan, so they have to make sure to give it to him with a matana gemura, even if he decides he doesn't want to go through with the wedding, that it should be his. The Pesachei Tshuva discusses an interesting case. What if the girl has a ring that she wants to give the chassan to do? Most girls are not going to do this. They want to get, if they have a ring already, they get a second ring. They're not going to give you one of their old rings. But let's say the girl has a ring that she wants to use as the tabas kiddushin. So can she give the ring to the chassan in order that he should give it back to her as a tabas kiddushin? So the Pesachei Tshuva calls him a chassan sofer. This depends on any baya, the love sheet, and the gemara meseches get. The gemara is the baya. Let's say the paper of the get belongs to the woman. She's going to give the paper. The get has to belong to the husband. So she's going to give the paper of the get to the chassan. He's going to write the get and then give it back to her. So Gemara has a shaila, can a woman make such a nuanced kinyan? She's going to give it to him knowing full well that she's going to get it right back. So does she really ever have in mind to give it to him in the first place? So that's an ibaya the law of Shita in the Gemara. So the Chasam Sofer was willing to be makel on that. That yeah, we can assume a hakel on that. That she can give him the paper that he should write the get and give it back to her. But then the Sefer in Nisuin Kilchasi calls him Rabbi Yashiv was a little more machmer on that. That she cannot, we should be machmer in that ibaya the law of Shita in the Gemara. And Rebbe Avadia was more makel. This comes up not so much with women giving rings to a chassan, but if let's say you make a mistake, the husband, the chassan, when he's giving the ring to the kawa, so he's supposed to say, we'll get to it in a minute, Hare at mekudesh li b'tabazu kadesh mos of Yisrael, and then put the ring on her finger. Lots of people get very anxious. So he says, Hare at mekudesh li b'tabazu, and he throws the ring on her finger, and then he finishes talking after the ring is already on her finger. So you're not supposed to do that. Or, so, okay, so start over. To give her back the ring and start over. So can you do that? She already got the ring. Or let's say, right. Or this comes up also, let's say, he says, Arabic, Kudesh, Libit, Tabas, Duke, Kudesh, Moshe, Yisrael, and then he drops the ring. And then everyone's looking around for the ring, and I don't know where the ring is, and she gets the ring, and she gives him back the ring to start over. Can you start over after he gave her the ring? So that's this Shaila. Can she give him back the ring to start over or not? So, but we're going to see, though, that probably all of these cases are fine because of a sukkim boso inyan. We all know what's going on over there. There's a whole wedding hall, and she's wearing white, and he's wearing a suit, and he's a kittel. We all know what's going on over here. So even if he would say basically nothing, the kiddushin would be good, but we'll get to that in a second.
He doesn't have to do it over?
Huh?
He doesn't have to do it over?
He does. You're supposed to do it over.
Well, the original one was good.
Just probably was good, yeah.
The words cannot be shared as
right. But it makes a difference what people have in mind. If you say, the Sefer HaMakna writes, you're supposed to give it after you say what you're saying, because if I give it to her before, then she thinks, oh, this is my engagement present. Now, where's my Kesef Kiddushin? meaning everybody knows that they know the pismon goes haray amu kadesh li kadesh moshe v'yisrael. So if you give it to her before, let's say I give her something, you know, before we start the wedding, as an expression of love, he gives her X gift. So then this looks like that because it was before he finished talking. Yes, we all know what it means. You're probably right. The kiddushin was probably good the first time. We all know it's a sukkah bosa inyan. He's giving her a ring. He's wearing the chuppah. They just took a picture. You know, we wish him out of. So we know what's going on. But lechatchila, you're supposed to put the ring on the finger after he finishes talking. I would mention that to the chassan before he gets there. So after you make sure you have your ring, so you're going to walk underneath the chuppah. What does the chuppah represent? So the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Samach Alf Sif Alf Kuz Machlokas have shown him what is the nature of chuppah. The opinion of the Rambam is that chuppah is Yichud Aroy Lebiya. And the opinion of the Ran is that it's more of a Knisa L'Rishuso. He's welcoming her into his Rishus. So the Nafkamina will be whether or not you can do a chuppah's Nida. According to the Rambam, you cannot do a chuppah's Nida because you need Yichud Aroy Lebiya. It's not Roy Lebiya. And the Shulchan Aruch is machmir like the Rambam, that you cannot do a chuppas nida. But according to the Ran, that it's a knisa l'rishuso, so the Rama says then you can do a chuppas nida. Rabbi Vadi already writes in the Abi Omer that even Sfardim do a chuppas nida. Sfardim are not machmir like this Rambam, not to have a chuppas nida, but they do a chuppas nida. If it is a chuppas nida, by the way, so the Berahetev points out, like our many, the Minigashkin has certainly to do a chuppas nida, so the Berahetev has the raises the shayla, how can he pass her the ring? Quotes a Maril, how can he pass her the ring? It should be a shayla of harchaka. One of the harchaka is not to pass thing from one to another, so maybe he'd have to drop the ring into her hand. And I think in the Nefesh HaRav, he quotes from the Rav like that, that he shouldn't put the ring on her finger if it's a chuppas nida, he should drop it into her hand. So the Otar Poskim raises the problem why should harchakas be relevant here? They aren't married yet. Harchakas come after they're married. Here they're getting married. They're not yet married though. So how can the harchakas be in play? So it really shouldn't be a problem with the harchakas. What I think they're more concerned with though is, Rabbi Black, by the way, I think he mentioned this, that's why the chassan, lots of times people have the notion that the chassan is supposed to give the ksuba to the kala after the ksuba is done being read, or some misadri kiddushin will give the ksuba to the chassan, and he should give it to the kala as a kind of edi mesira karsi. Rabbi Bleich discussed it this year. So Rabbi Bleich is not in favor of it because he doesn't think it's necessary. We don't say edi mesira karsi on the ksuba, it's a shtarai and not a shtarkinyan, but also because then it's a problem of passing things from one to another. Now they're married. And now he's passing it to her the ksuba. So if it's a chuppas nida, he can't pass her the ksuba. And if he's not going to pass it to her, he just broadcast to everyone. Assuming he didn't drop the ring into her finger, he just broadcast to everyone that it's a chuppas nida. So fine. But here, they're not yet married. So what should be the problem? I think what they're more concerned with is the fact that by putting the ring on her finger, he might come to touch her finger, which would be a greater concern. But even there, most of the Otsar Poskim quotes that many Poskim are meiko, because it's not derech chiba, v'taivos bia, it's not lustful. And besides which, it's only for a second in front of a whole large crowd. So they quote from a Yushalmi in Masechah Sota, that Yushalmi says when a woman would come with a Mincha Sota, so the Kohen would have to be Meinif the carbon together with the woman. They'd have to wave the carbon together. So she would put her hands underneath his. So Gemara asks, how can they do that? They're touching each other. She's a married woman. So Gemara says, well, maybe there was a cloth there. And the Gemara says, no, there wasn't a cloth there. It's a chatzitza. So Gemara ends up saying, well, it was only for a second and everyone's watching. It's not the time for the Yitzhah Har to be sholeit in front of everyone. This is a mincha sota. So too, many of the poskim say here in front of a whole wedding hall, putting a ring on a finger in the middle for 1 second in front of everybody, that's not a time. That 1 second, you should have the same heter that Yushalmi has for the mincha sota. So that's why many poskim even would put the ring on the finger, even though it's a chuppas nida. The Ramah writes, we have the machlokas of Rishonim, what is the chuppah? Is it a yichud avayu labiyah, or is it a knisa l'rishusa? We passing like the Ramah, and the Ran, that it's a knisa l'rishusa. So therefore the Ramah says the minig is that we make chuppah with, you know, poles and canopy. That's based on the Ran, that it's like a knisa l'rishusa. She's entering his rishus. Because of that, some poskim have suggested that since it's like a knisa l'rishus, that this has to be his house, and what do these poles represent? It's like a Tzuras HaPesach, that perhaps you have to have 4 kosher Tzuras HaPesachs. So it can't be a Tzuras HaPesach min Hatzad. It'd have to be Agabeim. Rav Shechter in his Sefer Erev Bikvei Hatzon, Simon Lamites, has Ha'aris about Nisuin. It's a wonderful article. So I think the first Ha'ar that he has is he quotes these poskim who say that the chuppah has to be kosher Tzuras HaPesach. So he disagrees, and he makes the argument that it's not a knisa or a shuso of a Tzuras HaPesach, it's more based on the Pasuk in Rusu, for us to knofecha al amasecha, that he's spreading his garment over her. That's the kind of that's the symbolism of the chuppah. Like the yekis, they both sit under the talus together. So that's what the chuppah basically represents. But because of that, he once suggested, at a wedding where this wasn't the case, he once suggested that perhaps the chuppah has to be made of cloth. If it's made out of flowers or wood, then that's not ufarasa kanafecha ala masecha, it will be no good. So you have to make sure that the chuppah is made out of cloth. I've been looking ever since I was at a wedding with him. One of my chaverim is here in the yeshiva now, so he teaches in yeshiva. So he it was at his wedding. Mshalta came in, he was Masada Kiddushin, came in to look at the chuppah. And Mshalta says to him, "Where's the chuppah?" He said, "The Rebbe, it's right over here. What are you talking about?" So he says, "No." He says, "It has to be made out of cloth." He said, "Why not made out of cloth?" So he told him this whole story, and it was made out of flowers. So he said, "It's not a chuppah. They had to get an old yellow talus they find somewhere underneath that ruined all the pictures or something." So he said to him, "Rebbe, you know, he was in the shir for a long time." So he said, "Rebbe, I never heard this, that it has to be made out of cloth." He said, "Yeah, I thought of it just now." Next time, you know, tell him to come late. Anyway, so that's the whole purpose of the cloth. Of the chuppah. Perhaps it's ufarasa k'nafecha l'masecha. That can also be the pshat in the shita that the Rama quotes, which is another opinion, that the chuppah is when the woman walks out with a veil over her head. Mishayata bihinuma. That's nisuin. Which the Drisha and the Dagam Ravava point out in the Hilchos Avelos of all places, in Simon Shin Mem Beis and Hilchos Avelos, that that's the makar for the practice of having a bedekin. Is to be choshish for that shita, that when he spreads the cloth over her face, when she walks out with a covered face with a veil, that that's nisuin. So we're choshish for that opinion by having the bedekin, which is perhaps also the nisuin. So it turns out you're having the nisuin before the kiddushin. It's discussed by all the poskim. Can you have nisuin before the kiddushin? Because she's having the bedekin before she actually gets the ring. The Or Sameach and the Mar Cheshes and the classical Achrayim discuss, do you have to have Eidim? We know you have to have Eidim by the Kiddushin. Do you have to have Eidim by the Nisuin as well? So the Minig is to, they discuss this Shaila, maybe yes, maybe no. The Minig is to be Machmer to have Eidim by the Nisuin. That's why if you're ever called up as an Eid Kiddushin, you should stand there the rest of the time. The Minig is that the Eid Kiddushin stand there on the side. That's not just because they want to get in the picture or they want to be there to wish Mazel Tov. It's because they're the Eidim on the Chuppah too. So they stand there till the Chuppah is over, because there they ate them on the Nisuin. And that's why the minig is, by most places, to have ate them on the Cheder Yichud, to be choshish for the opinion of the Rambam, that the Cheder Yichud is Nisuin, and to be choshish for that opinion Achronim, that you have to have ate them by the Nisuin. I don't think that many are machmer, minig is not to be machmer, to be choshish that far by the Bedekin, to have ate them on the Bedekin. The Bedekin already itself is a chumrah, to be choshish for a third opinion, what the chuppah is, and then already to throw on the Shaila of the Achronim, they have to have Eidim by the Nisuin, to have Eidim by the Bedekin, is really a lot. I believe in the Nefesh HaRavi quotes that the Rav was Machbid to have Eidim by the Bedekin, but I don't believe it's the Minig by others, but if you had to ask me, I'd suggest that perhaps the Rav was making a point of having Eidim by the Bedekin to show people this is not just a ceremony, it actually has halachic significance. But whether he actually believed that you needed Eidim by the Bedekin, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's not surprising. I'm saying that was the Rav Shita, okay?
Yeah. Aaron Feldman was inside the Kiddush, and he got two people to be
Eidim at the Bedekin. Okay. It's not the common meaning, though. I mean, I hear it, but it's not, I don't believe it's the most common meaning. So once, now you arrived at the chuppah, let's go through you figured out that you are actually, in fact, standing underneath the chuppah. So the first thing you have to do is position the chassan and kala. There are three minhagim. I always say if there'd be a fourth minhag, there'd be no, couldn't discuss this issue. But there are three minhagim. Which direction are the chassan and kala supposed to face? North, south, or east? Nobody says west. So the Rav's opinion was it should always be east. The problem is if you do, I think we should have to quote it in one of this farm. If you do east, so then it turns out the chassan and kala are sometimes standing at a diagonal, sometimes they're standing at funny angles. I don't believe that's the common minhag. And the Knesset HaGedolah already points out that since there are so many minhagim about this, should it be south, north, or east, that it really at this point doesn't make any difference. So lots of Masada Kiddusha will ask a chassan and kala. You want to face the crowd, you don't want to face the crowd. Some Masada Kiddusha think it's nice to face the crowd, so they'll always face the crowd. The mice, many are not makbid on which direction the chassan and kala are facing. The Berhetev quotes him in Maril that the kala should always be standing on the right of the chassan. That is universal. The kala should always be standing on the chassan's right. When you come in, you position them one way or another, either facing the crowd, not facing the crowd, and the kala should be on the chassan's right. Then you have to call up the Eidei Kiddushin. Rabbi Bleich, I don't know if we got to it. This is what I would recommend you listen online. Rabbi Bleich discussed whether or not you have to write, whether or not you have to say that these I'm calling up these Eidei Kiddushin to the exclusion of all others. Rabbi Bleich made the point that you cannot exclude other, I can't passel people to Eidos. The whole point of calling up two Eidim is people are Eidim whether I want them to be an Eid or not. I can't say, well, before I murder somebody, to the exclusion of you two. It doesn't work like that. Eidim are Eidim whether I like it or not. So what it means is that I'm creating a separate group of Eidim with vis-a-vis the rule of Nimtzeach Mehem Karav Apostol. I'm creating a separate Kas Eidos so that even though they're Krovim, Imsuim in the crowd, they shouldn't be considered all of the same Kas, and this is a separate Kas Eidim. So that's what you mean, everybody means by that language. So the question is, that's what Rabbi pointed out, that to use the language of to the exclusion of all others to kind of indicate that I'm apostling other people for Eidos is relevant. Everyone knows what you're trying to do is create a separate Kas Eidim. Those who use that type of language are just trying to emphasize the point that this is a separate Kas Eidim, meaning you people are not part of the same group, but certainly I'm not apostling other people the Eidos. So you have to call up the Eidim, and the Raman, Simen Mem Beis, Sif Dalet, says that the Eidim have to see the Kiddushin itself. The Beis Shmuel has a Shaila, is it enough with Eidus Yediya, or perhaps they have to have Eidus Re'iya, they actually have to see the whole thing, or it's enough that they know that what happened. And this has a major nafkamina with regards to the Chumer that the Pesach Yeshuva quotes in the name of the Maharit, who quotes in the name of his father, the Mabit, that you should see the Kala's face. Sometimes, if you're at a chuppah where it's a thin veil and everyone can see the kala's face, the shayla doesn't come up. But if you're at a chasana where the veil is thicker and you can't see the kala's face, so even though I just saw her at the bedekin and it looked like the same dress, I can't say that I see that this is the kala. I see that this is a girl, we hope, but I see that someone under here, but I can't tell that this is the same kala as before. So then how can the aid? Oh, but they'll see afterwards. The Pesach Yeshuva discusses maybe is Yediyah, is Re'iyah Achar Kach considered Eidus Re'iyah, or is it not considered Eidus Re'iyah? Perhaps it's just Eidus Yediyah, so the Marit, according to the name of his father Mabit, you should really lift up the veil to make sure that it is in fact the Kalan. And the Marit disagreed that that's enough with Yediyah, and besides which, you're going to see immediately after the chuppah, she's going to pick up her veil to walk out, you're going to see who it is. So that in fact is Eidus Re'iyah. So Yitzchak Ochanan and others have Tshuvas that you don't have to be Machmir on this. But there are those who are makbid to lift up the veil to make sure that the kala is in fact who she says she is. Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he quotes from the Chasam Sofer in the tshuva that if it turns out one of the Eidim was puzzled, let's say we figure out after the at the Suda one of them gets indicted, the police come in with handcuffs and that was our Eid Kiddushin. So now what happens is the chuppah, we have to go through everything again. So the Chasam Sofer says no, because we could assume that everybody, even though nobody else saw the ring changing hands and everybody, but we all saw, everybody in the room was Eidim to the Kiddushin. Even though they didn't see the ring changing hands, and certainly even if they lifted up the veil, the Eidim saw who it is, but that's like people in the back of the room. But the Chasam Sofer says, even if I saw nothing, but I'm standing in the back of the room, but there's a Rav Muvhak who's being Masada Kiddushin, and everybody screamed Mazel Tov, that I could assume that that's what happened, meaning it's enough with the Eidus Yediyah. I know this rabbi, he's a Rav Muvhak, and presumably the Kiddushin he did was valid, so then I'm an aid now on the Kiddushin. Rav Moshe quotes that the Kiddushin then, the Kiddushin would in fact be valid, just by fact by standing in the back of the room. So therefore, you don't have to be so quick to do the chuppah again if the guy gets indicted. And so you have to have a good time somewhere. Simon Bamid Hesiv Beis, the Shulchan Aruch discusses whether or not, what's the nature of the Birchas Eirusin. It's my focus between the Rosh and the Rambam. Is it a Birchas Shevach V'Odah or a Birchas HaMitzvah? The Rambam's opinion is a Birchas HaMitzvah. The Rosh's opinion is a Shevach V'Odah. The Nafkamina will be, do you have to do it over Lasiyazin or not over Lasiyazin? According to the Rosh, the Shevach V'Odah should be done afterwards. And the Chalkas Mechokik and the Beis Shmuel say, if you didn't do it before, you can do it afterwards, like the Rosh. Let's say you're so nervous, you didn't make the bracha, and he said, Arei Mekadesh Shemich Abadzu, and then he gave the ring. The Masada Kiddushin is nervous, his first time. So then he can make the bracha afterwards. But L'chadchila, you're supposed to make the bracha before, like it's like over Dasi Yosan. So then Rav Shechta points out in his Bikvei Yatzon over there, in the Minhagim of the Chasana, that it should be over Lasi Yosan, but not over the over. It shouldn't be like when you make a bracha on the talus, you're not supposed to make the bracha on the talus while still in the zakah, while still in the bag. You're supposed to take the talus out, hold it up so it says quick, because right after you make the bracha, you could in fact have your mitzvah. So too over here, the Masada Kiddushin shouldn't make the bracha, and then after he makes the bracha and everyone drinks from the wine, then he's going to start asking the Edom, is it worth it? Shavu Pruta, is it yours? Well, he could have done all that before, and it's not over Lasiyasan. So Rav Shechter recommends that you should ask all these questions before you ever get started. Make sure the Edom here, the Chassid says this is his ring, and he has the ring ready, and it's worth a Shavu Pruta, and get all that out of the way before you ever start with the bracha. The Rama writes in Siman Lamed Aleph that the minhag is someone else makes the bracha, not the chassan. So the Beis Shmuel says the reason is not to be mavayish a chassan who doesn't know how to make a bracha. However, many pasuk suggest that it's not the reason why, it's not to be motzi, the chassan in the bracha. Rather, perhaps it's because we try and fulfill the opinion of the Rambam to make the bracha over l'asiyasan, but really we paskin like the Rosh. We said if you forgot to make it over l'asiyasan, you can make it afterwards. Really, we paskin like the Rosh. That this is in fact the Birchas Shevach Vahodah. So then why does someone else make the bracha instead of the chassan? It's because this is not his bracha. This is a bracha for everybody who's at the wedding. It's a Shevach Vahodah on behalf of all of us who are in attendance at the wedding, that we give Shevach Vahodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the institution of marriage. But it's not the chassan's bracha. It's all of our bracha. So therefore, Rav Shechter continues over there in the Bikvei Hatzon that perhaps then the Masada Kiddushin should be, the one who's going to make the bracha should be someone who everyone would choose. Lots of times you have a chassan comes back from Eretz Yisrael and he's particularly close with a certain Rebbe and he flies him in for the wedding and everything. But then, you have Moshe Feinstein at the wedding. And then you have this 26-year-old Rebbe from some yeshiva that opened 2 years ago. So who should be the Masada Kiddushin? So he feels particularly close with this Rebbe, but you have the Rashka Bahag over here. So Rav Shechter makes the point that it really should be whoever we would all choose as a Masada Kiddushin. It would not be the 26-year-old Rebbe from Eretz Yisrael. It would probably be the big posek here in America. So therefore, that's the person who's Masada Kiddushin should be the one who everybody would choose as a Masada Kiddushin, because it's not the Chassan's bracha. It's the bracha that's on behalf of everyone. That's why Rav Shechter quotes in the name of the Rav, that he noticed, I think, that whenever Rav Moshe was at a wedding, the Rav would defer to Rav Moshe. Why? Because he felt that Rav Moshe would be the person who everybody would have chosen, not necessarily himself. So the same, Rabbi Blach, I think, has pointed out the same should be true with regards to the Shevet Brachas. The Shevet Brachas are also a Birchas Shevet Vodah on behalf of everyone. So lots of times, in order not to get involved in picking Rabbanim or whatever, avoid Machlekes, so they give the uncles, and they give the 14-year-old kid who's in high school, and this one, and that one, and then they don't give any 10 Rabbanim over there, and they don't give any of them. They're giving the uncle from, out of town. So then that's also the question. Even though that's who these people feel closest with, but perhaps the Shevet Brachas are really on behalf of everyone, in which case it would be the person who everyone would choose. But they're not footing the bill, so you never know. Anyway. Then in Shulchan Aruch Siv Beis, after you make the bracha, before Harei HaMekudesh L'Bitabazu, the Masada Kiddushin gives the chassan and kala to drink. The Pnei Yoshua has a gaval de kakasha. The Pnei Yoshua asks, how could it be the Masada Kiddushin himself is not drinking? He made a bari priya gafen. How could he not be drinking? So therefore, the Sefer Afike Yam quotes in the name of Reb Chaim. There's two parts of the Afike Yam. There's the two halakim. One before he learned by Reb Chaim, and the second one after he learned by Reb Chaim. So the Akdama to the second one, he says his whole world changed when he learned by Reb Chaim. I think even the second one, the print is different. Before you got to the reprinted ones, the one I had when we were growing up, the print in the second one was much clearer and was bigger block print, and in the first one was Rashi script and much tighter together. And the whole world opened up for him afterwards. So he quotes over there in the second half, after he learned by Reb Chaim, that the Reb Chaim held after the Masada Kiddushin should drink from the coast. So that's where you got this, he wiggled his hand or whatever, and then he licked his finger, a whole story over there, how he drank from the coast because of the Pnei Yoshua's Kasha. How could it be? He's making up a Birchas Hananin and he's not drinking. So the other post can say that's a good Kasha, but we do it all the time. But Hilchas Mila, if you remember, it's on a Tainus in Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av. If you have a meal in Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av, who makes the bracha? Whoever gets called up to make the bracha b'riyah gafen. And who drinks? Either the Oledes, perhaps you give to the Tino, perhaps you give to a Katan, but not the guy who makes the bracha. So the poskim there ask also, how could it be? He's not drinking from the coast, he's making a birchas hananin. So it's a good kasha. Pnei Yoshua's kasha is a good kasha. There's a teretz to that kasha. Whatever the teretz is beyond the scope of our discussion, but it's a good kasha. But Lamaisa, we do it all the time. Then a guy makes a bari priya gafen in the context of a mitzvah, even though that's a birchas hananin, we assume he does not have to drink necessarily himself from the coast. So therefore, the Aruch HaShulchan and the Marsham, Rav Shechter also, but I think they even say in the Brisker Svarim say that the Afike Yam got it wrong. Reb Chaim never held like this. I think in the Matike Shmua, they said they asked the Brisker Rav about this, And he said he never heard this from Reb Chaim, that the Masada Kiddushin has to drink from the cup of wine. So the minhag by most is not to drink from the cup of wine. Anyway, the Masada Kiddushin, though, should give to the Chassan and Kawa to drink from the cup of wine. The minhag is, by the way, the Masada Kiddushin doesn't give the cup to the Chassan and the Kawa, he gives it to the parents. He gives the cup to the father, and the father gives to his son to drink, or to the father-in-law, and they gives it to the mother, and the mother gives to the Kawa to drink, because the Masada Kiddushin will spill it all over. Dressed and proper, you should give it to the mother, and the mother will give it to the Kawa to drink. After you do this, then you have your nusach of the Kiddushin. We mentioned that even if he messes up on the nusach, so the pashup shot is, Shulchan Aruch says, Masukim Boso Inyan. If everybody knows what's going on over there, they rented out a hotel and everyone's standing in their clothing and they're taking pictures, that obviously that this is a wedding that's going on. So even if the Aruch HaShulchan says and others, even if he messes up in the lashon of the Kiddushin, everyone should know what he's talking about, and the Kiddushin is probably valid, but you should start over and make sure that it's done in a proper way. The Berheitev over there, in Simon Samach Aleph, says that the Chassan is supposed to give the ring from his right hand to her right hand. It shouldn't be from his right hand to her left hand, it's from his right to her right. If he's a lefty, it's from his left to her left. And over there, the Berheitev says he's supposed to use the finger that's next to the thumb, which is the pointer finger. Not because they had a minhag to wear rings on that finger. Everybody knew the ring finger was over here, but this is the easiest finger to put a ring on. She sticks out this finger. He's trying to stick out this finger, it's much harder. So she's to stick out her pointer, and then he puts the ring on that finger. After you're done with all that, and then someone spoke, he read the ksuba, so then you have the Sheva Bracha. So the Pisrei Tshuva, I want to just say one thing about the Sheva Bracha, and then one other thing. So Pisrei Tshuva says, in Simon Samach Beis, if Kohen Yud Beis, as a Machlokas HaAchronim, when do you start counting the days, the days of Sheva Brachas from? Do you go based on the time of the Chuppah or based on the time of the Suda? The Chalkas Machokek's opinion was you go based on the time of the Chuppah, and the Knesset Yecheskel disagreed. And he held you go based on the time of the Suuda. Most poskim do not paskin like this Knesset Yecheskel. They paskin that we go based on the time of the Chuppah. I believe in the Sefer Ahoy Yeshurin, which is Rabbi Felder's Sefer. We used to talk about it a lot more when we learned to have Shekelim and Tfilas Kelim. Rabbi Felder has a wonderful sefer called the Holy Yeshurin, where he discusses Yichud, Hechshir Kelim, Tfilas Kelim, and Sheva Brachas. Interesting collection of topics. So in the section on Sheva Brachas, he quotes from Ramosha that Ramosha, I think, was more sympathetic to the Knesset Yechezkel, that perhaps he should go based on the Suda. Either way, it would be based on the beginning of the Suda. So let's say the chuppah is, but the minhag of most is not the father. The minhag of the most people is the father chalkas mechokek. So if the chuppah is one day, and the suda will be at night, let's say the chuppah is nowadays at 6 o'clock, and the suda is not until tonight, so the sheva brachas already start counting from today. If the chuppah is at night, so then you start counting the sheva brachas at night. Then the Pisrei Tshuva also mentions that we don't go meyes liyes. We go based on days. So if, as long as it starts before Shkia, today would be the first day of Sheva Brachas, and it's over. And then we don't go based on 24-hour periods. We don't go based on 24-hour periods. So therefore, by the way, every Sunday wedding, that's a real Sunday wedding that happens on Sunday, the last of the Sheva Brachas is Shabbos. In which case, the last of the Sheva Brachas will probably be Shal Shudis. In which case, you have to make sure that the Sheva Brachas by Shal Shudis are before Shkia, because you have to finish before the day is over. The Holy Yeshurin quotes from Ramosha that perhaps you have a little bit extra time. Perhaps you have 40 minutes, because it goes based on what we colloquially call days, not Meyes Liyes, but we colloquially call the day, and we would still call it Shabbos for 40 minutes after Shabbos. I don't know. If you want to be Mako like that, that's Ramosha's opinion. But most held that it has to be done before Shkia on the seventh day. So if any Sunday wedding, which is a popular day to have a wedding, has the Sheva Brachas have to be done on Shabbos before perhaps before Shkia Sachama. The Berheitev in Simon Samuel Beis of Kohen Aleph quotes from in Igeres HaRambam that if you confuse the order of the Sheva Brachas, it's still okay. If you put Sos Tosis before Sameach the Samach, the guy gets confused, it's kosher. But Moshe quotes from in the Achronim on the Shulchan Aruch that there's one exception to this rule. If you put Asher Yotzer HaAdam B'Tzalmo before the Brach of Yotzer HaAdam, so then that's out of order. You can't say Yotzer HaAdam. You can't say Yotzer HaAdam after Asher Yotzer. You already said HaKadosh Baruch Hu created him. How can you say thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu for creating him? You already discussed the creation. So therefore, you can't. Once that comes out of order, if you do Asher Yotzer HaAdam before Yotzer HaAdam, then you can't go back. So the nefesh, I think in the Nefesh HaRav, he quotes like that from the Rav too, that you can't go back. Those two brachos, if you confuse them, you can't go back. But then he says one time there were seven rabbanim at a wedding, and they told them all they were each getting a bracha, and one rabbi messed up. And he said, this bracha, Shayotar Sa'adam before Yotar Adam, and the Rav felt bad. It was a covered up brios issue that this Rav wasn't going to get a bracha, so he allowed them to go out of order, even with regards to this. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Interesting myself. If you do, of course, normally in a standard scenario, there's 7 days of Sheva Brachas. If you have a more complex relationship, though, let's say one of the husband has never been married, but she was married, it's a second marriage for her. It's a second marriage for him and a first marriage for her, so you still always have Sheva Brachas. As long as it's someone's first marriage, you always have Sheva Brachas. If it's an Alman and an Almana, then you only have 1 day of Sheva Brachas, the day of the Chuppah. You basically have the day of the Chuppah, and that's basically it. The Pesach Teshuva and Sifkat and Tes raises a scary Noda Behuda, that the Noda Behuda says it could be that if they're both Be'ulos, you also only get 1 day Sheva Brachas. Which means if I'm invited to a Sheva Brachas and they're both Be'ulos, I know they're both Be'ulos, I'm closest to both Be'ulos, I can't make the Bracha the Sheva Brachas, because the Bracha of Atala on the third day or fourth day, they might only get 1 day according to the Noda Behuda, if they're both Be'ulos. But then he quotes, because perhaps a Be'ula already that takes away from the Simcha of the marriage, because they're not Besulim, so it's not that he's never had a relationship, she's never had a relationship, both of them had relationships before, so then in which case he can't, perhaps there's no 7 days of Sheva Brachas. So then the Noda Behuda though quotes Mekilim, though Tzara Poskim quotes more Mekilim, that perhaps there's the newness of first time being married, even if it's not their first time engaging in relations, but the first time being married, so perhaps the Sheva Brachas for that as well. That's an interesting discussion in the Pesachei Teshuva over there.
Quick.
A ger.
Have you been married before their ger was? Is that
I would assume that there's no Sheva Brachas, but I can't speak to that with confidence. I would assume that's the case. Because it has to do with the newness of being married. They've been married. I would assume it's a psychological principle, but I don't know.
Doesn't the Gemara say that any time within the Shana Rishona they make a suda l'kavu, the chasen and the kalas, they make Sheva Brachos, and why should this be worse if everyone's getting together making a big suda for the chasen and the kalas, which is anyhow the only time we really say Sheva Brachos, why should this be worse than that?
Interesting point.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't say Sheva Brachos, they should have something for the mona.
Right.
During the year, you can only have something for the mona.
Yeah, you don't say Sheva Brachos, yeah.
Sheva Brachos is a din.
Good point. These are long Pesach Teshuvas. Go ahead. Dig in. The Shulchan Aruch and Siman Samach Vav, Sif Gimel. Last point. The Shulchan Aruch and Siman Samach Vav, Sif Gimel discusses what happens if after the wedding they say the Sheva Brachas is finally relieved, the whole thing is done, is behind you, and now they call you that they lost the Ksuba. So the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Samach Vav, Sif Gimel discusses that issue that you're not allowed to be Mesiachim without a Ksuba. That's the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah disagrees, and the Ramah says that you're not allowed. Not to have yichud without a ksuba, you're not allowed to have beer without a ksuba, but you are allowed to be misyachud without a ksuba. So either way, you're going to have problems the night of the wedding if they go home without a ksuba. So what are you supposed to do? So the first thing you're supposed to do is make sure that this doesn't happen. Is you're supposed to, after the wedding, after the chuppah, when everyone is, all excited and pandemonium breaks, the rabbi should have a clear head and take the ksuba and make sure that someone takes the ksuba who's watching over what's going on. So you should take the ksuba and make sure that the mother-in-law walks away with the ksuba. You can make sure you give the ksuba to the chassan. But Rabbi Bullock points out in his practical Siddur Kiddushin Shia that strictly speaking, the chassan is not supposed to be the one with the ksuba. The whole point is that it should be a protected document for her, that if she ever gets divorced, she should rely on the safety of the ksuba. If it's in the hands of the chassan, so he might have sinister intentions. So therefore, it should be in the hands of the mother-in-law. She should watch over it. Rav Moshe writes in the Teshuva that if she trusts the husband that he can have the possession of the ksuba, but the Masada Kiddushin should make sure that someone takes it and puts it away in a safe place. But if the scenario does arise that the ksuba is lost, so the Sefer Ksuba Kelchasa quotes in the name of Rav Vosner, first of all, 2 a.m, if they get a call, they can't find the ksuba. So the Rav Vosner writes that has no cheskas aveda. Someone probably has it. The whole probably has it. The Pashup Shad is it's not lost. So Vosner says, it's a convenient sock. Rav Vosner says that, we could assume someone has it. You're not calling everyone who attended the wedding at 2 a.m. So you can assume someone has it and we'll find it tomorrow. If you're convinced that it's lost, you know that it fell out of the window of the taxi or something, you know that it's lost and they don't have access to it, so then... Then there are different stadim that the Shulchan Aruch brings up, which you could rely on. The Shulchan Aruch in Sif Aleph mentions Well, the fact she might rely on the fact that the two Edom who signed the ksuba are still alive, even if there's presumably from the night before they're still alive. So then you could assume that they could just testify to the fact that they signed the ksuba, even if the ksuba is not around. The Ramah disagrees that a woman is not going to be samech on the Edom, but that's one side. Or perhaps the Ramah brings up the svara that perhaps the only reason that they're not supposed to be misyachid or not supposed to have bia without the ksuba is because it's going to be kalabain of lotzia. He'll divorce her willy nilly. So the Ramah says nowadays that we have the chayim derabenu gershom, he can't divorce anybody without against their will. So he's not going to divorce her so easily. So perhaps if you put that together, but I think Rabbi Willick suggests that if you put that together with the fact that she relies on the Edim, the fact that it's not Kalabena Votzias, the Ramah says perhaps this whole issue doesn't apply anymore, because you can't divorce her easily, and perhaps the Edim, she relies on the Edim, so you have what to rely on to allow them to be continue to be Mesiachet, Abiyah, without the Ksuba. Obviously, the next day you should rewrite the Ksuba, if you can't find it, but you can rely on that. The Shulchan Aruch Siv Beis mentions that he could also be Tofes Metaltoin. She could he could write her a check for, $20,000 for the Iker Ksuba. The Tosefik Ksuba she doesn't need, but the Iker Ksuba, he could write her a check for $10,000, and then she has that to rely on. So if he wants to do that, you could do that. And Rabbi Book, I think, suggested that's also a good idea, that you should write her a check for $10,000. Might also help. This is also relevant, by the way, if you realize underneath the chuppah, which happens, that there's a mistake in the ksuba. Let's say the guy's reading the ksuba says, hey, Masami Yavushin, you left out something over here. So do you have to stop right then in the middle of the ksuba, the chuppah, and write the ksuba? So no, you tell the guy, continue reading, and you can allow, Rav Shechter has pointed this out, and you can allow them to go to the yichud room without the ksuba, even though the ksuba is puzzle. You can allow them to go to the yichud room without the ksuba, because, again, the Edom are right here. They didn't die in between the chuppah and the yichud room. And also, you have the Ramah, that it's not kalabein of lahotzia. So because of that same kula, if you realize there's a psul in the ksuba before the yichud room, you can continue and should continue to allow them to go to the yichud room and rewrite the ksuba after, during the pictures or something.
The Edom being there doesn't help.
No, the ksuba is a document which is a proof. But what they're really testifying to the fact is that the chassan obligated himself in the obligations, which is the kinyan. All the ksuba is a proof that the husband picked up the pen and obligated himself. Yeah, but he obligated himself to it. The ksuba is just a proof of document. It doesn't affect any change. It's just a proof to it. Okay, shkayach rabbi.